whether we're exploring the latest in heavy equipment technology, talking about the trends that propel the industry forward, or uncovering stories about the dedicated individuals who keep the dirt moving and the wheels of America turning. This is where the roar of the engines and the pulse of progress come together. It is sublime. It is surreal. It's the Heavy Equipment Podcast with Mike and Joe.
All right, Hepcats and Kittens, this is going to be a little different because we've already started talking about this.
We're way into this.
So here's all the background that you need to know. If you were a child in the 70s and 80s and you ever took a road trip, you stopped at a rest stop. And at that rest stop, you could put in a quarter, maybe 50 cents, and you could order vanilla cappuccino, a black coffee, some of the most scalding hot cocoa in the world. And it would come out of the vending machine at 272 degrees, ready to burn your crotch off. And it would have some poker cards on there, and you could play poker with your buddies who also got their own coffee.
You beat me to it.
That's the one. And now the real question, the only question that matters today, folks, should there be one of these vending machines at the Mandalay Bay Starbucks in Las Vegas?
I say yes. Let me tell you, when you walk down there at 4 a.m. because you're on East Coast time and you got up because somebody woke you up out of bed with a serious problem, and you handle it and you go down there with your cup, all I got is a Mandalay Bay robe, some slippers, and I got my mug.
That's it.
I'm not talking about my face. And I need coffee. I get about 1 million gold stars from Starbucks. I don't care if it's going to cost me 1,000 of them. I need a cup of coffee.
That's absolutely right. There is no reason that in Mandalay Bay, in a world-renowned Las Vegas hotel,
one of the
with
best,
the Voltaggio brothers taking up residence in their restaurant, that you should not be able to get a cup of coffee at 5 a.m. That's absurd. That's a war crime. I think it's against the Geneva Convention.
How long can this go
on? From now on, I want you to put an equal amount of blueberries in each muffin. An equal amount of blueberries in each muffin.
You know how long that's going to take?
I don't care how long it takes. Put an equal amount in each muffin.
And they go, do you know how long that's going to take? I don't care.
I don't care.
Because, and I don't want to say it's about lowering your standards. They haven't lowered their standards. It's just one of those weird things that when you're 3 hours apart from their time, you know, let's face it, all us Midwesterners, we get really tired of the crappy weather because now that our weather's changed a little bit, it's like living in Seattle all the time. Seattle folks, but
they know
you're about to be blessed with some serious great weather because we just got all your weather. So I'm just telling you right now,
one of the drawbacks of climate change. You know, it's bad for most people, but for some people, it's going to work out really well.
Oregon. You're welcome.
Oh, the Canadians? Toronto is going to be a paradise. It's going to be like Myrtle Beach.
Let me tell you, the Toronto people, they're going to be up there looking out, you know, and breaking off pieces of their frozen maple syrup bites and dipping them in their coffee that they got from their Canadian vending machine because they have great things up north of the border.
That's right.
And they're going to go, wow, this is nice. What the hell happened to the frozen tundra we used to live in?
Oh, I know. It's going to be good.
They got some brutal stuff up there.
They do. Well, you know, it's funny because we're talking about Las Vegas. We're talking about these Las Vegas hotels. We haven't talked about why the Heavy Equipment podcast was in Las Vegas last week. Young Michael was on a press tour, a little bit of a press junket, if you will, at an EV charging summit. And he was there as a guest of General Motors. And you were checking out the GM BrightDrop. That's their new big box van. How'd you like that?
Yeah, I was out there. I mean, it was a cool work event. You know, we went out there and did that. And I looked at the BrightDrop and I looked at the Silverado EV. They had the Hummer and the, you know, and the Vette and all that stuff was all out there too. But another cool thing that they had in addition to that was GM Power. They're doing like literally like crate motor options, but electric motors.
Yes.
Not engines, crate motors.
Motors that you can then drop into your chassis configuration or RV or bus line or whatever else.
And the guys at Leboy, they had their Roscoe brooms out there with the electric version.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I kept this from you for a reason. The 8 hour runtime that it has under full load is amazing. And then you plug it in at night.
That's it.
They also had a battery powered electric paver for cities that want to do some paving, but don't want to have all the engine issues. Plug it in, charge it up. Hey, we had to go down here because, you know, Mrs. Johnson, she called because there's water coming up out of the road. You get that fixed, you still got to pave it. This is a better solution.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, especially when you look at municipalities and cities and the kind of stuff that they operate, they are really beholden to their constituents, right? Like the people that voted you into power, they have their goals, whether they make sense or not, whether it's mathematically feasible or not. You want to stay in power, you got to do what they want. And a lot of those municipalities, especially in California, Pacific Northwest, even here in Chicago, they don't want the noise. They don't want the sound and the vibration. You have to go electric just to meet their demands.
Exactly. I mean, between the broom, the paver, and the brake drop is actually a really good van. And at the company that I work for, we're having some internal meetings about it and how it does fit a need, right? Even at a construction company, which is what brought me out there. I wanted to learn more, and I went through some educational modules with them. I wanted to understand, like, how do you actually include EV into your fleet for the type of work that we do as an industrial construction company, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not alone. I met with several fleet managers out there that I knew from throughout the country, and we all had the same question was, this is all really cool when you're a consumer, but how do I use this in everyday life for our day-to-day construction needs? And we went over and we looked at the Ford Lightning was there. The Transit was there in its electric forms. The Silverado EV is an amazing truck. I drove it. They have you do an acceleration test and all that. And that accelerates as hard as the Tesla Model Y. And I can tell you, because I've been in both, that thing moves.
Yeah.
And if you are working, speaking of municipalities, if you are working in a municipality, or if there are some elected officials listening to this episode, you need to be seriously taking consideration to the Bright Drop and the Silverado EV work truck. The Silverado EV work truck comes with standard options as a work truck configuration, which 20 years ago made it a superstar truck.
Yeah, that made it an ultimate luxury truck. There's exactly. A couple of neat things about the Silverado that GM really did right, and they really separated themselves from the Lightning and the Cybertruck and all that. It's an 800-volt architecture battery pack.
Correct. But
one of the things that they've done is it's a split system. So what does that mean? That means that you can, through software, turn that 800-volt battery into two 400-volt systems and plug it into two DC fast chargers and get out of there even faster. You can also use it as a charger on the move. So if you've got another vehicle that needs to be charged up, whether it's, you know, a golf cart or a mini excavator or something, you can plug it into the Silverado's big bad battery and it'll charge that for you. It's a really slick truck.
It's got a 240-volt outlet in the back. And I asked him flat out, I said, so if I show up on a job site and I'm in a real hard pinch here and I got to get out my air arcer and I'm going to air arc some bolts off of a cutting edge, they didn't recommend it, but they also didn't say you couldn't.
Yeah. So, I think that may have more to do with the fact that, like, it will hurt.
It's sensitive.
It's not sensitive. It'll hurt your range, but it's smart enough to protect itself. You're not going to hurt the truck. And it's just really sharp. It's one of those things where you understand what they did. You understand why they've done it. You go, wow, they really did this right. Where I think they screwed up was they gave it that avalanche style pickup bed that's integrated into the body, and now you can't put a utility body on it.
Well, there were several concerns about that, and that shark fin deal that they've got on the back, the fairing and all that. While it looks cool, you can't, as a municipality, put a composite bed on that thing yet. You can't put a lightweight aluminum bed on it. And I think the reason that they did that, they're using the same underpinning against a couple platforms, right?
Yeah, it's a consumer platform, quote unquote.
Right. So they took that. Now, one thing that they did do right with that, and you can see it when you see the truck in person. It's the same with BrightDrop. They said, we're not going to do like what Ram did, right? Ram's got the electric truck coming. It's a pickup truck that they've had forever, and they put an electric powertrain in it.
Right.
Well, we're trying. I need to go look at that, and I'm going to go do some comparative testing with that. Lightning is very similar. Lightning's an F-150 that they put an electric powertrain in.
That's exactly right.
Silverado was engineered from the ground up for what its intended use is. Not any more and not any less. It is meant as a true EV vehicle. If you want to use it, use it. If you don't, go get a nice powered pickup truck. And they're not bashful about saying that either. They're not jamming it down your throat saying, hey, look, you know, this is the way it's going to go. No, if this fits your needs, use it. If it doesn't, there's gas lineups across all the brands. Go check them out.
That's right. And now, honestly, we talked about this in one of the early episodes. The gas lineup at GM is every bit as powerful and every bit as capable of towing as what people are used to from diesel.
That's correct. And BrightDrop, that's another thing. That is a composite and aluminum body. It's got in the floor. I talked to the one of the design team members that actually put 1,500 miles on their BrightDrop. GM had them drive it across the country. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's got low center of gravity. The battery's in the floor underneath the rear cargo area. It's between the bulkhead and the front axle, or the rear axle, the front of the rear axle. So it's between the two. I drove it around, made laps. They had a whole course set up. You went out on some public streets. Not only does it scoot, it's quiet for a box truck because it's got composite side panels. And it has an aluminum frame. It's solid. And it's comfortable. Set it up for one pedal driving, just like the Tesla that you're used to or anything else like that. Drives around like a golf cart.
Yeah.
If you're overlooking that vehicle, I think you're doing a disservice, because both of those vehicles seriously have a place in any kind of crew environment where, hey, I got to run to Home Depot and go grab this stuff. Hey, I got to run down and grab some parts from the truck parts place. It's sitting there being charged. Go take it, go pick your stuff up and come back. For either one of those options, they both have great payload capacity. If you get the 600 model BrightDrop, you can put a bunk of plywood in the back roughly, and you can put a 16-foot long 2x4 in there. I don't know how you go wrong with that.
No, I think that's going to be a good vehicle. And I think, you know, there was a couple of people that were surprised that's a class 2 vehicle. It only has like a 3,800-pound payload in it. But it goes back to the right tool for the right job. If you're trying to move massive amounts of weight, that's the wrong vehicle for you. That's for moving cargo and moving stuff, you know, to and from job sites. And I think for that, it's going to work really well.
Exactly.
You know, we're talking about using the right tool for the right job. One of the things that I always felt was kind of a prime target for electrification, obviously, is delivery vans, route vehicles, things like that, like we've been talking about with BrightDrop. But also, I got to say, we got to talk about yard dogs and terminal trucks. And these guys from Orange EV, we got turned on to them a couple of weeks ago. We talked to them at the Vegas show.
This meeting is being recorded.
Good. The Zoom meeting robot tells us we're being recorded. I love it.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Kurt Neitkins from Orange EV. If you're not familiar with Orange EV, they build the e-Trever and the Husky yard dogs. This is an electric class 7 and class 8 heavy duty semi. You see them all over the Port of Long Beach and some other ports throughout the country. And, you know, they're going to be kind of all over, I think, soon. You're getting a lot of great press for these things. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time and having me on. It's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Yeah, it's exciting for us too, because I think, you know, there's so many real hardball questions that can be asked about electrification and EVs, about where we get the batteries from and is it really clean and all that. But I think we want to start off with an easy one. The e-Trever has by far the best name in the entire electric vehicle space. I love the logo. I love the little iconography. I think it's great.
Thank you. Thank you. We love it. It makes it a little bit more cheeky, I guess. You know, the one thing that's interesting about these vehicles, they're not in the public eye. You know, no one drives a yard hostler around the neighborhood or to work one day because they only go 33 miles an hour or less. And so, you know, each company has their own name for it because they're not talking to each other about it. So the name is Yard Dog, is the name we've kind of settled on. But you have, we call switchers and mules and shunts and stevedores, and there are literally 20 different names to call a yard dog. And so, but for us, the e-triever, you know, signifies your, and I know you've got a dog, and anybody who has one knows that they're pretty loyal. They like to fetch and go out and get trailers and bring them back if they can. And they're always there for you. So we thought that really kind of fit with our brand. And so we were pretty excited to call our trucks, you know, the e-triever and the Husky.
Yeah. And I love these two trucks. So the e-triever, I think, is the newer of the two models. Yes.
No, actually, it's the other way around. The e-triever we've had, we started out, we called it T-Series originally, and then we changed the name to e-triever when we made a major upgrade back in 2018. And we did a big upgrade to the really to the electrical architectural of the system, and allowed the truck to be much more digital, is the way we think of it. And so we have controllers that can look at things like the lights, and if the light goes out, we know what happens. If one of the circuits gets a short or an opening, we can detect that with the controllers. And so there's a major upgrade to do that across the vehicle. But that's when we started the e-triever. We've been selling and delivering electric yard hustlers since 2015. The company started in 2012. We delivered our first truck in 15. We changed from T-Series to the e-triever in 2018. And then just this last fall, we introduced the Husky, which we consider to be a stronger, heavier duty vehicle. That's why we call it Husky. And, you know, instead of pulling 80,000 pounds, the Husky can pull 180,000 pounds. And instead of a max speed of 25 miles an hour, it can pull that 180,000 pounds, up to 33 miles an hour. And so it's definitely a different vehicle, two different market segments. And so we have two different vehicles. That was a long-winded answer.
No, that's a great answer. You know, and it's funny because we are the heavy equipment podcast, but we're, you know, I also write for Electrek and in the past Clean Technica and all this. So my focus has always been on electrification and EVs. And we get a lot of heat from that. A lot of the operators, a lot of the trucking guys, they don't want to talk about electric. They just want to talk about bigger, heavier. 180,000 pound hauling, that's pretty heavy. I don't think you're going to find a lot of, you know, a whole lot of diesel competition out there that's going to do any more than that.
No. And that's what this truck was made. The Husky was made specifically for the ports and the rail application. We actually have two versions of it. We have a rail version, a port version, but it's the same powertrain and the same architecture. Well, it's not exactly the same powertrain. They do different things, but the same bases on the two vehicles. And so, you know, in the ports, they'll pull what's called, unbelievably, a bomb cart. And the only reason I can imagine that it's called a bomb cart is because you can have a bomb next to it and still stick around. But they call it a bomb cart. There's probably a better reason for it. No one's ever been able to explain it to me. But you can put two containers, two 20-foot containers, onto one trailer, effectively. And so these trailers, they pretty much just stay in the port, and they move containers from the rail or from the ship to, you know, set enough to get to pulled over the road. And so to get that ship unloaded as fast as possible, they'll put two containers on the same cart and pull that with a yard hostler. And so that's why you end up pulling 180,000 pounds GCW.
That's wild. So tell me about this. You know, you guys were one of the early adopters. I mean, you had vehicles in customer hands 4 years before Tesla even decided they were going to start talking about a semi. So you guys are really the innovators in this space in terms of class 8 electrification, class 7, class 8 electrification. What made you presumably wake up sometime in 2010 or 2011 and say, you know what the world really needs is a giant electric car?
Yeah, I like the way you put it. you know, it was a process, just like most things are. I was with Ford for 17 years. They taught me a ton. I still highly respect the company and think they were just wonderful to me. And so, but from that, you know, back in 2005, they gave buyouts and they said 30% of management, we would like you to leave. So go find another job. Who wants a buyout, right? And I said, well, if I'm ever going to do something my own, here's my chance. And so I've been trying to do electric vehicles ever since then. Some of those, the first thing I did, I completely failed on. So I tried to do an electric Mustang and F-150s out of my garage. And, you know, while I made one, no one ever bought one. So that didn't work so well.
You're ahead of your time.
yeah, well, maybe. Or I didn't understand the business model very well. It's probably a more accurate description. And then helped a company doing airport tugs from there create a line of all electric and then lithium ion trucks for airports. And on the way to work one day, you know, I had, when I was with my, doing my Mustang, I had made a math model very, after I kind of failed there, I made a math model of every vehicle I could think of and could I make it make sense financially, right? And really, there was not much on that list that made sense. There's airport tugs, which I wasn't going to take that business with my boss, right? That wasn't the idea, or my employer. There was, on the other side of the airport, where you shuttle people from you know, the cars back to the airport. And I said, that makes a lot of sense, but I had just left Ford and I knew they weren't going to give that market up very quickly. And the day they had an electric, you know, van, that powertrain in a van, that business goes away. And I had already done the Mustang, so I realized that's probably not a good one. And so I said, you know, maybe there's nothing out there. And I was driving to work one day and I actually saw a yard hostler in a parking lot and I didn't know what it was. And I drove up to the driver and said, tell me what this thing does. And he said to me, get off my lot. And I said, but I just tell me what this truck is and what it's called. And he says, a hostler, get off my lot, you know? And so I was trespassing. And so I left and started looking on the internet for what a yard hostler was. And, you know, it just all made sense. The heavier your vehicle, the more your payback is. The more use you use, the more your payback is. And so we get excited when we have customers who run 24/7 because we know that their payback is going to be significant, right? We've got customers running 24/7 that can pay back in, you know, a year, right? The upfront cost versus the diesel, their payback is in the first year, just in fuel and maintenance alone. Now, if you run two shifts, maybe that's 2 to 3 years. And if you run just one shift, maybe that's 4 to 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. Depending on how hard you run. And so and we do our best to kind of right size the vehicle and the charging system to maximize their payback. But everyone gets a payback and the trucks run better than the diesels. And so that helps too. But just fuel and maintenance alone, you know, repair stuff, we pay back very, very quickly. And so that was all kind of understood up front that this would make sense. And so, you know, there's also the benefit of there's no range anxiety because you're right there in the lot all the time, right? And so there's also, for us, we're direct to the customer service. So it's OrangeEV employees living near their customers with a van with parts in it. And either for maintenance, if they want to go do maintenance, you know, preventive maintenance, or if there's a repair, we're right there. We go to them. We get them back up and running. These are mission critical vehicles. Our customers can't have downtime. On the diesel side of the world, if they have 5 diesel trucks running in a given lot that they need, they'll have 2, maybe even 3 extra because those 5 are down so much that they have to have extra, right? Our uptime on our trucks is, you know, on average for our fleet right now, It's over 97%.
Wow.
And if you think about the diesels, they're buying 2 extra for 5. That's not 98%, right? That's 75%, right? And so it's really a better vehicle. We'd like to say it's because it's an orange EV vehicle. Others have tried electric, and I don't want to badmouth anybody, but you know, others have tried and they haven't gotten there yet. But
well, those guys don't come on my show, so we can badmouth them all we want. You send me a list, I'll make sure to we'll spend 20 minutes on them.
I appreciate everyone who's trying to help us make this transition. Really, you know, ultimately for me, Joe, it's I started this because of the mission. I wanted to make a difference in the environment. That doesn't always necessarily play well, but I'll say this, and I think everyone can get behind this. I'm not saying, we're not saying do this because it's green. We're saying Orange EV had a responsibility to make the very best truck at the very best financial benefit out there and compete on every level in every category and beat the pants off the competition, hopefully, in every category. And that's why you're going to go help the environment, because all the things for your business make sense. And
yeah,
so that's how we're looking at it. We sell very few vehicles because someone needs an ESG target, right? But we sell almost all our vehicles because it runs better, its uptime is better, or there's money there for the customer.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because there is money there for the customer, not only in terms of savings and maintenance, but there's a number of kind of new rebate programs and initiatives where, you know, local governments have kind of decided that they're going to pick a winner and say, we're going to help subsidize and expand electrification. So for a lot of these customers that are eligible for those rebates and incentives, are they seeing a payback faster than a year, or is that included in that?
No, that payback is with zero incentives that I've talked about so far. That's all with zero incentives. Now, just this last year, the IRA grant said anybody who buys one of our trucks, and we had to be qualified for this as a qualified manufacturer, but anybody who buys one of our trucks can exercise a $40,000 tax credit in their federal taxes. So that's new, and that helps. And that wasn't even in the discussion of the payback I talked about. So it helps a little bit, depending on their operations. That might make it, you know, 6 months earlier, maybe even a year earlier, but depend on their operations and what they're doing and what they purchase from us, right? What they buy up front. So there's that. There are incentives out there, but for the last 3 years, over 50% and sometimes as much as like 65% of our sales have been without incentives. So, I mean, that just tells you, like, customers are buying this because it makes sense. Right? It's not because they're getting an incentive,
right,
necessarily. Now, what we see is it's scary to get into a new technology. You know, a person who's deciding this for their company, right, their job's on the line. Boss, I want you to go buy from this little company who, you know, started out in a garage with $50,000. So we're much bigger than that now. We're a major player in the industry now. But, you know, back in 2015, when DHL bought that first truck and put it in Chicago, you know, we were 10 people in the company, right? And they said, I'm going to take a risk on this. I'm going to see if these guys got something. They got an incentive. Right. But they still paid as much as they would have paid for a diesel, even though they got an incentive. And so they were taking a big risk. Right.
Yeah.
If this doesn't work, what are they going to do? Right. They're going to pay another $150 to go get a diesel in here. Right.
That's right.
So they had to trust us. We had to earn their loyalty. You know, I think those incentives help that decision maker reduce the risk of losing their job if they're wrong, right?
Yeah.
Now, we do our best to make sure they're not wrong and they become heroes. And so right now, DHL, you know, 2 months ago, I don't know if you saw it, Joe, but there was maybe it's not 3 months ago, they did a press release with us. And they indicated they already had 50 trucks in the fleet. That first one, 2015, that they bought and put in Chicago, is still running. And they say that in the press release. And they mentioned that it had 24,000 hours on it at the time. You're a truck guy, right? You know what 24,000 hours means. It now has 25,000 hours on it. I looked a couple weeks ago, and it's over 25,000. You can see that in our telematics very easily. And they also said we're going to buy another 50 this year in 2024. And in 2025, we're going to convert our complete fleet to Orange EV electric.
So, I saw that. That is huge news because, I mean, ultimately, there's a couple of ways of building trust, right? There's proving the product, but that's kind of hard to do with one of these unless somebody buys one. But when you have someone like DHL, when you have a pedigree like you have coming from Ford, those are big names. And to see DHL say, you know, not only is our first one in operation all these years later, but we're going to go 100% Orange EV by the end of 2025. I mean, you can't beat that for endorsement.
You can't. And you know, it indicates a couple of things. You know, they are not waiting till their diesels kind of end of life, right? They're going now. Right? And, you know, they are not saying I need incentives to do all of these, right? They're saying I'm going now. And what I would submit to you is if our customers understood everything we understand about our trucks and you know, we got over a thousand trucks out there right now running every day. Their best financial and operational decision, both best financial and operational decision, is to park their diesels, buy our trucks. Even if they don't sell the diesels, they're still ahead. A customer who buys one of our trucks, who's running two shifts, you know, hard two shifts, comes out close to $1 million ahead. Now, it's more in California. It's a little less than the rest of the country because the fuel costs are different, right? Depends on maintenance costs and stuff, obviously, whether they do that work internally and they have their own maintenance team or they farm that out to a third party, right? Those things are big factors in how much it costs them. But we see over $1 million on a 10-year life of the truck. And that first truck in Chicago is 8.5 years. All our trucks are still in the first battery pack. We've never replaced the battery pack.
It's funny. That was exactly my next question was going to be about the batteries, because you will see articles and the websites that I contribute to are guilty of this as well. Well, you see an article will say, you know, this Tesla has 1.2 million miles on it, but it's on its third or fourth battery pack. Your trucks are on the first battery pack. I assume they've got better than 80% capacity still. And after 24,000 hours of use, that is an astronomical number. I don't even know that there's, I mean, what do you see in terms of diesel for hours of operation? 15, 20,000 hours in a diesel, you're doing a major overhaul.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, typically what we see is 3 to 5 years and maybe it's seven. You know, we've seen as little as three, I should say 5 to 7 years typically is what our customers tell us about when they're trying to get rid of their diesels, right? Depending on how hard they run. And we've seen as low as three. I would not call that industry norm by any means. But in this application, yard hustlers, they work harder than any other truck out there. You know, think about what they do. They're backing into a trailer up to 150 times a shift. And that interface, when you hit that trailer, that can be up to 25 Gs, right? So you do that 150 times a shift, and then you start and stop. You got heavy loads. You are turning all over the place, right? You're scrubbing tires left and right. You are idling a lot because you're hooking up trailers every time you hook one up, right? And so you idle a lot. Idling's hard on ice engines, right? And so it's a really, really hard application. And so, you know, when you see that, you take that and you put an RGB electric into that, it can just completely change someone's basis for how things work.
Right. You know, and it's almost an application that's ideal for electric because you're low speed where the electric motors are most efficient. You need maximum torque to get them off the line, which is exactly where electric motors kick in at zero RPM. If you have a diesel truck, you have to constantly worry about getting fuel in and out, if not going and finding fuel if you run out of it. On an electric vehicle, it's right there. You already have port power. You've already got power for those big cranes that are lifting those things. So you're just tapping into that. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's an initiative right now at Port of Long Beach and Port of Houston to build charging into the ground. So these things theoretically never have to stop.
Yeah. That's absolutely, you know, I'm not as familiar with those programs. I know there's work being done. We actually have an inductive system that we've developed for our e-Treever that we're selling. Our first vehicles will... we expect them to deliver in July of this year.
So, that's awesome.
It's not in the ground. It's, you know, you drive up next to it, but you know, it's inductive. And so you never have to plug in. The other thing I realized I missed, or I went in a different direction on you, about the diesel hours. I didn't ever answer that. So, I was saying that, you know, diesel is typically 5 to 7 years. But also that first overhaul is probably between 15,000 and 20,000 hours. We've seen them out there that make it to 30,000 hours, right? But they're definitely end of life at that point in time. Someone's using it as a complete backup. They're not using it for the main truck. We talked about the 25,000 hours on these trucks. We actually have other trucks that are over 27,000 hours already. That's someone who ran faster and harder than DHL did with that first one, right? We have trucks running 580 hours a month, month after month after month. Just think about just how good your uptime has to be to do that, right? You can't fake that, right? You can't fake it. You either are making those numbers or you are not.
That's crazy. That's 70 shifts a month. Like full 8 hours of operation. That's bananas. Well, Kurt, you have just been absolutely awesome. I want to be mindful of our time commitment here and not go over. As we come to the close of this, number one, I hope this is the first appearance of many. You've just got a tremendous product. I know it's going to continue to grow as more people find out about it. Is there a specific question that I didn't ask that you kind of wish I had that you have a better answer for than anybody else? And I'll give you that. I'll say the floor is yours and then we'll sign off.
Well, I would say one thing, you know, the question everyone has is charging and infrastructure. And the thing that Orange EV has tried to do there is minimize the footprint for the customer. And so what we did was we have, for a couple of reasons, we made a charger that is specific for our truck. We did that originally because there were no chargers. You couldn't buy one. When we started, we didn't build our own charger. There wasn't a way to charge our truck. So we had to do it. But when we did it, we said, how do we make it so that they have the minimum infrastructure cost possible? And so our charger doesn't need to have infrastructure that allows it to charge at, you know, 200 kilowatts, and yet we only use 20. It uses 20, and the grid gives it 20 times 1.2 because, you know, the National Electric Code says make sure your wiring stuff is 20% higher than what you need, right? And so but we only need, you know, 22 kilowatts, so we get to a 26 kilowatt unit or feed, and we can run 20 hours a day on 22 kilowatts. Now, think what that means is, you know, how much is 22 kilowatts? No one has a sense of that. That's about halfway between your dryer and your stove at home, your electric stove, right? So it's not that much, right? Now, if you do 200 kilowatts, which is a lot of the new chargers out there, they want it to work for everything. And so they put this great big infrastructure bill in, and it takes you, you know, 3 years to get the utility to show up at your place to tell you how much it's going to cost you, right? And you can do one truck instead of 10, and you have all these issues, right? And so I think one of the big important factors here is is how we do infrastructure as a community. And, you know, that's one of those things, like, I can talk, we could have another show on that. And I'd be happy to talk about that and kind of hopefully share some ideas about how we can do it all better and allow the grid to extend to a lot more vehicles with the same grid.
Yeah, and I think that that's definitely an important conversation. I'd love to invite you on, and we'll do a whole conversation about grid stuff with some other utility people. I think that's I'd listen to that. I think that'd be a great show. Kurt, thank you so much for being a part of this. For people who want to find you online, learn more about what you're doing, they go rngvs.com. Do you have a TikTok where you guys dance on the desk, or what are some other ways to follow along?
You know, we're in, yes, you can come to orangeuv.com. There's lots of information there. We're for sure happy to have someone call us direct. We sell direct, we service direct. So we're very open to inquiries. But then we're also on Facebook. We're on Instagram. I'm not a social media guru.
You got an intern for that.
Team members. I have team members who are, you know, we've, you know, while we started humble, you know, we've got 350 plus employees now. And so, you know, we're a big team, and thankfully I've got experts on that stuff. Unfortunately, I'm not even versed on it. So I know we're out there, but I think Facebook's a great place to find us.
Absolutely. All right. Once again, that's Kurt Nightgens from Orange EV. Thanks so much for being a part of the show, Kurt. And we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Those things are so cool, man. It's very cool.
Well, they used to upfit loaders and all kinds of stuff for doing that, you know, over the years. Like, I've seen a bunch of stuff like that done.
Yeah, but these guys are doing it as an OEM from an OEM perspective, and they have the best names in the business. They have the e-triever for their yard dog. Instead of a retriever, it's an e-triever. It's got a little dog as the logo, so that's cool. Yeah, I like that. But anyway, you know, we're talking about all these trucks. We're talking about all these, you know, different applications for these electric trucks. We still don't have anybody to drive the things. You know, we always talk about this ongoing labor shortage in the industry. We don't have enough drivers. We don't have enough operators. We don't have enough technicians. Well, now we're starting to see programs come out to effectively get people behind the wheel of these things for free. So this is a free CDL program that they're putting out in Oregon. They've got 325 new truck drivers will receive 100% paid for CDLs as part of a $3.5 million federal grant. And it's really important here to understand that nationally, this is a $500 million grant. So this is going to put a lot of new drivers on the road. And unlike the last 15, 20 years of doing this, the drivers aren't going to have to pay for it.
Listen, I mean, $500 million investment, that's a lot. That's saying something. You know what I mean? I would be curious to see where they're pulling the funding from, but that's a whole rabbit hole we're not going to get into now. We need these programs.
Yeah.
We can't get enough people that can drive, and everybody knows it. We talk about it all the time. Every one of these programs we get is just profoundly important. And I just met today with a concrete supplier, and he's talking about how it's so hard to get drivers. They got trucks sitting, you know, the guys come and go. You get some transient guys that only want to work when they want to work, and they accept that because they don't have enough people. And it doesn't matter. Every time you talk to somebody, they talk about a driver shortage. They can't get people to drive. I'm hoping that with free driving courses, I think you're going to find that there's some people out there that might be stuck in a situation where they want to get out of. Maybe they need to transition away from a job they're in now.
Yeah.
And maybe they can stomach taking some PTO and then some time off unpaid, but they can't afford paying the premium of a truck driving school. I think you're going to find some good people that just want to get a different start. Yeah. You know, nothing wrong with that. That's awesome.
No, and it's noble work too. I mean, it's work that you're going to pay for your family. You're going to pay for, you know, you're going to be able to support a family with it. You're going to be able to do real honest work. And one of the things that I always want to highlight whenever we talk about the trades, whenever we talk about education. You know, I've been accused of being anti-college because of some comments I've made on the show. Nothing could be further from the truth. I am pro-education. I just don't think that education begins and ends with Shakespeare or art history or whatever else, right? Learning how to weld is an education. Understanding how the built world around us works is an education. And unfortunately, if you're trying to get qualify for like FAFSA or federal student loans or anything like that, most banks, most federal programs will not enable you to finance an education in the trades or a commercial driving school like this. It's actually easier for a young cat to go $100,000 or $200,000 into debt to learn underwater basket weaving and art history, you know, European politics from the 19th century, than it is to get financing for a truck driving program, a welding program, an apprenticeship. So that's kind of why programs like this are so important. And frankly, why unions are so important, because a lot of the UAW unions, the operator unions, they do have apprenticeship programs that help people get into these trades and get into these kind of different jobs.
Here's the thing. All knowledge is learning. And how you obtain that knowledge, whether it's through a degree, through an established school, through somebody that is certified to train you in whatever you're doing, or through some other method of absorbing this knowledge, like a free program, an online course, something like that. All of that is education.
Yes.
We don't have to label it college, this, that, or whatever. College is another vehicle of getting education. Put right. A college together that trains people in their skilled trade, gives them work, puts them to work as they're an apprentice, and takes them in and out of that and does all that training and see what you get. Oh, we have those. They're called unions. They train people. They put them to work as apprentices. They put them through a specific skill set. And the good locals, and I've been in the meetings where we've had to do it, there are times where you tell people, this isn't for you, but I already called the BA over at this union, and I'm telling you, this is a good fit.
Yeah.
So before you get too far down the rabbit hole with your apprenticeship, go over there to the millwrights and go over there and do that. Or, you know, and then it's vice versa. Sometimes you get guys who are like, this guy's a hell of an operator. I want you to put him through your apprenticeship program because he deserves to be over here. He's not going to work out with what he's doing here. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, we're talking about finding your role and finding how this works. Yeah.
Finding your role is more important than any other thing that we talk about when it comes to education. You got to find your place, find your knowledge set of what you can absorb and what you can make sense of with your brain. When you do that, you're going to be successful. And that can only be accomplished by what? Ambition.
I know you have to want to. And I think that gets lost so much. And, you know, I'm struggling with this now. You know, it's trying to get the kids, especially the college age kids in my life, to like really want to take that next step and kind of leap into that career. And it's hard. But I think that what we've really hit upon here is a new marketing angle. We're going to start HEP University. We are going to issue 4-year bachelor's degrees in operating, in welding, in all the trades. And we're going to do it in concert with the unions. The unions are going to help these kids pay for the education. And because it's a 4-year degree at the end of it, they'll be able to take out the federal loans that they need to live on, to put a roof over their head and food in their bellies while they're learning their trade. So, for those of you interested, you know, be sure to send an email to hep.edu. I assume that's real. And yeah, someone will be with you shortly.
Biff literally tore up a pad behind the screen, threw it in the air, and walked off to the bathroom, which I assume is why he carried a stack of magazines in there, because he's done listening to us for a good solid hour until we're done here.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, Biff's done with us and you should be too. So tune in next week for the next exciting episode of the Heavy Equipment Podcast. We didn't even get to Murphy Tractor. We'll cover them next week. We'll give them next a good week. give them a good half hour.
Hey, wait, let me tell you something about that. You guys need to listen in for next week. So we talk about EV and we get basically messed up over it all the time. But if you want to talk about something that actually burns diesel fuel and will remove an entire fairway from a golf course, to put that in tangible perspective and relocate it to whatever place on this planet you'd like to put it on, that's what we're talking about on the next episode.
That's right. And in honor of Murphy Tractor, we're going to play the SpongeBob theme song.
Oh, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
SpongeBob SquarePants!
Absorbent and yellow and porous is he?
SpongeBob SquarePants!
If nautical nonsense be something you wish,
SpongeBob SquarePants!
Then drop on the deck and flop like a fish!
SpongeBob SquarePants!
Ready? SpongeBob SquarePants! SpongeBob SquarePants! SpongeBob SquarePants! SpongeBob SquarePants!
Be sure to subscribe and follow for more heavy equipment podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts.